In the grim darkness of the far future, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Quite literally, the Imperium of Man, an empire of a million worlds and uncountable human souls, must feed its people amid never-ending war and cosmic horror. How does humanity survive mealtime in the 41st millennium? With a mix of brute force industry, grim pragmatism, and a willingness to eat things that would turn your stomach here and now. From recycled corpse biscuits for the teeming hive masses to lavish banquets in a planetary governor's palace, food in the Imperium is a tale of extremes. It's a story of survival at any cost. So steel your gut and say a prayer to the God Emperor. It's time to explore what's on the menu for mankind at the end of the galaxy. Feeding a galaxy, agri-worlds, and tithes. Feeding countless trillions of human beings across the galaxy is a task of imperial proportions, pun intended. The Imperium's solution is as vast as its appetite. Entire planets designated as agri-worlds, whose sole purpose is to produce food. These are farming planets on an unimaginable scale, each devoted almost entirely to growing crops or raising livestock to ship off-world as part of the Imperial tithe. The food from these worlds is not just for local consumption, it's destined for distant hive cities, forge worlds, and military forces that cannot feed themselves. Imperial propaganda paints agri-worlds as rustic paradises, endless golden fields under pleasant skies, humble farmer folk living simple, virtuous lives to feed the Emperor's people. The reality is far more brutal and industrial. The Imperium is no gentle custodian of these planets. It exploits them with ruthless efficiency. When a new agri-world is brought into production, the first step is often terraforming by force. All native life on the planet is wiped out, burned away in controlled firestorms, or devoured by engineered microbes to make way for standardized Terran flora and fauna. Forests, native animals, even inconvenient bacteria are purged to clear the ground for imperial wheat. Protein-rich algae pools or sprawling grox ranches. The atmosphere might be chemically adjusted and weather-altered by orbiting machines to ensure optimal farming conditions. In short, the planet is broken and refashioned into a giant, high-yield food factory. After decades of preparation, an agri-world will begin to resemble one enormous farm. On some, you could walk for days in one direction and see nothing but rows of identical crops swaying under hazy skies. Hazy skies indeed, because the yield is pushed so hard that massive quantities of chemical fertilizer and growth accelerants are used, often tainting the air and soil. Workers, those few humans actually needed to supervise the servitor farming machines, must wear rebreathers as they toil, since the very air can turn orange and caustic from constant spraying of nutrients and pesticides. Entire continents might be carpeted in a monoculture of a single hardy grain. Processed corn is one common staple, a high-yield, bioengineered cereal plant that can grow in poor soil and is packed with calories. So ubiquitous is this crop that misunderstandings can arise between imperial cultures. One infamous story tells of a hive-born soldier mistaking a tin of camo face paint for a standard-issue food paste made from corn. There are also agri-worlds focused on raising livestock, especially the all-important grox. The grox is the Imperium's favorite herd animal, a disgusting, temperamental reptilian beast originally from one world but now found on many. Grox meat is nutritious and, when properly processed, quite palatable, and these creatures can survive on almost anything. They'll eat grain, garbage, or each other if penned too closely. However, they're incredibly aggressive. Herding unmodified grox is practically suicidal. The standard solution is to lobotomize the bulk of the grox herd to make them docile and control the breeding stock with neural implants and shock prods. Even so, accidents happen. An enraged Grox can and will bite an unlucky farmhand clean in half. But the Imperium deems the risks worth it. A single massive Grox can yield a huge quantity of meat, hide, and bone, feeding and clothing countless people. Grox are commonly raised in mega ranches on isolated agri-world plains, tended by mindless servitors and a few very brave, or heavily armored, ranchers known colloquially as Grox herds. The output of agri-worlds is colossal. At harvest time, great harvester machines the size of city blocks rumble across the fields, devouring crops wholesale. Picture a combine harvester, scaled up to a 100-meter-long leviathan, smokestacks belching black fumes, engines roaring, scythe blades cutting swaths of grain kilometers long in one go. Servitor crews or automated drones follow behind, gathering every last stalk. The raw food is taken to continent-sized processing plants to be cleaned, sterilized, and packaged. Much of it doesn't leave the planet as recognizable foods like wheat or meat. Instead, it's processed into shelf-stable forms for transport. Grains are ground into billions of tons of meal or starch powder, or baked into rock-hard ration crackers. Meat might be cooked down and pressed into protein blocks or tinned in brine. Everything is done to maximize the calories per cubic meter, since shipping food through space is time-consuming and precious. Once ready, the foodstuffs are loaded into massive bulk cargo landers and lifted to orbit. There, gigantic transport ships, void-faring mass conveyors, await, each capable of hauling enough grain or meat to feed a world for weeks. These ships then make the warp jump along established supply corridors, delivering their precious edible cargo to the worlds that depend on them. It's a constant galaxy-spanning supply chain, and like everything in the Imperium, it's stretched thin and perilously fragile. A single warp storm or pirate raid that knocks out a few agri-world shipments can send entire hive cities into hunger within weeks. The governors of agri-worlds carry a heavy burden, meet the production quotas, or face dire consequences. If pests devour a harvest or war disrupts the schedule, the shortfall in tithe could be seen as treachery or incompetence. There are stories of desperate agri-administrators resorting to sabotage and subterfuge to cover their failings, like attempting to steal or destroy a rival agri-world's crops and blame it on Xenos raiders, just to make their own yield look better by comparison. Such plots sometimes succeed, but more often they just add to the overall chaos and end in a quiet execution for the offending governor when discovered. Life for the people actually living and working on these farm worlds is incredibly harsh. There's a saying among indentured agri-world laborers: you come for the soil, you end up part of it. Many workers die each season from backbreaking labor, chemical exposure, or the simple fact that on a world of endless farms, people are as disposable as mulch. Those bodies likely end up in the processor vats, along with the Grox bones and corn husks. Everything is recycled for the war effort, even human flesh, though the workers aren't usually told that. Imperial propagandists like to distribute romantic holovids showing cheerful farmers under open skies, but the reality is more akin to a toxic factory floor that just happens to be outdoors. Yet, grim as it is, this system manages, mostly, to churn out enough food to keep the Imperium's billions alive. Quantity is everything. Quality is secondary. As long as the caloric quotas are met, no one in the administratum cares that the once fertile plains are being slowly turned into lifeless, chemical-soaked dust bowls. They'll drive an agri-world to total ecological collapse over centuries if that's what it takes. And when it finally fails, the Imperium will simply move on to the next undeveloped planet and repeat the process. Feeding the galaxy is a never-ending sacrificial cycle. Hive World cuisine, from sump sludge to spire delicacies. All those agri-world shipments typically end up in places like Hive Worlds, planet-wide cities housing populations in the tens or hundreds of billions. Feeding a hive city is an undertaking both monumental and, frankly, horrifying. A typical hive city towers miles into the sky, with layer upon layer of urban sprawl. At the pinnacle live the wealthy and powerful in relative comfort. Down below, billions of workers and slum dwellers live in squalor. When it comes to food, this stratification is extreme. The highborn might feast on delicacies imported from off-world, while far below, the masses choke down whatever foul nutrition they can get, including, quite literally, recycled human corpses. In the mid and lower hive, rationing and recycling are the norm. Most hive city inhabitants rely on whatever the adeptus administratum and local authorities allocate to them. For the vast majority, meals come in the form of unappetizing mass-produced foodstuffs. Think protein gruels, starch blocks, and nutrient bars that have all the flavor and texture of sawdust. The key ingredients in these rations? Synthesized proteins, often derived from algae or fungus. Starches from off-world grain shipments or reclaimed organic waste. And a healthy dose of chemical preservatives. It's not pretty, but it keeps people alive. Barely. The most infamous component of the hive diet is corpse starch. This is exactly what it sounds like, a food base made by processing human bodies. On many hive worlds, especially those with astronomically high populations and limited incoming supplies, the dead don't get a traditional burial. They're delivered to huge corpse reclamation factories. There, the bodies of the deceased, along with other organic waste, are rendered down into a gray, protein-rich paste. That paste is then formed into bland bricks or crackers, which are distributed as rations for the living. It's gruesome and morally grotesque, but in the hive, it's simply reality. Waste not, want not, is practically an imperial slogan, even if it means yesterday's co-worker might become tomorrow's lunch. Most hive citizens avoid thinking too hard about it. Complaining about the taste or origin of corpse starch is highly discouraged. In some places, it's even considered sedition to express disgust at your rations. Better to choke it down with a muttered prayer of thanks than to refuse and be accused of subverting the Emperor's provisioning. As terrible as it is, corpse starch at least provides calories. It usually comes pressed into hard biscuit form or canned as a sort of mush. The flavor is universally described as awful, like flavorless soy meal mixed with ash. But many hive dwellers have never known any other meat. In fact, some are so conditioned to it that they can't recognize real meat if they see it. There's a tragic anecdote from the Sabbat World's Crusade about a young hive-born soldier who, upon encountering a can of Imperial Guard camo face paint, thought it was some kind of food paste. Her unit's actual rations looked disturbingly similar. That's hive life in a nutshell. Food is often barely distinguishable from industrial waste. Beyond corpse starch, the lower classes subsist on a variety of other dubious nourishments. Algae broth is common. Huge vats of nutrient algae are grown in the hive's sump tanks and processed into a thin green soup or pressed into algae cakes. Imagine eating a slice of pond scum jello. It's about as appetizing as it sounds, but it's packed with vitamins. There's also fungus bread, such as the widely eaten mold grub loaf on Necromunda. Made from powdered hive-grown fungus, it's somewhat spicy, surprisingly nutritious, and entirely grown on sewage. In truth, a lot of hive food is just the byproduct of waste recycling. Yeasts grown on garbage, mushrooms cultivated in the dark, algae skimmed off toxic sludge pits. If it won't immediately kill you, a hive will find a way to eat it. Protein is often obtained through unorthodox means. Aside from recycled human protein, people raise or hunt what vermin they can. In the dark lower levels, rats, sump spiders, and scuttling sump prawns are trapped and eaten regularly. Entire hive market stalls might specialize in selling grilled rats on a stick or deep-fried sump roaches. It's not high cuisine, but when actual meat is rarer than gold, you take what you can get. Some underhive denizens even cultivate insect hives for their nutritious grubs, or catch flying critters attracted to the chem lights. It's all protein in the end. The drink of choice for most is reclaimed water, essentially recycled urine and moisture drawn from the air, filtered, one hopes, to be mostly safe. Hive water has a famously chemical taste. Citizens often flavor it with whatever they can. Bitter recaf powder or a squeeze of alcohol if available. As for stimulants, the hot beverage known as recaf, a catch-all for coffee/tea equivalents, is ubiquitous. Even in the grimmest manufactorum hab block, workers often start a shift with a tin cup of lukewarm, bitter recaf. It's usually made from crushed algae or chicory root, rather than true coffee bean, but it provides a needed jolt of energy and alertness. To say the hive city diet is monotonous would be an understatement. Most hab workers eat the same gray porridge or chew the same dry ration bars day in and day out for their entire lives. Fresh fruits or real vegetables are virtually unheard of at the lower levels. Some might see a withered imported apple once in a decade, sold at an exorbitant price as a curiosity. Little luxuries do exist. For example, some hive dwellers ferment their algae broth into a kind of bootleg liquor, or flavor their fungus bread with local spices or salts traded in the underhive markets. A notorious drink in some hives is Wild Snake Pale, named after the wild snake liquor of Necromunda. It's essentially homebrew alcohol mixed with whatever flavoring agents people can scrounge, sometimes including trace chems that give it a bite, hence the name. Desperate and likely toxic, but it helps dull the pain of existence. While the masses feed on recycled dregs, the upper hive nobility have a very different diet. More on that in the next section. Even within the middle tiers of the hive, there are slight gradations. A moderately successful factory overseer or tech guild member might afford occasional real food. Perhaps they can get a loaf of bread made from imported grain instead of fungus, or a slice of lizard meat from an off-world ranch. But such treats are fleeting. One month, you have a taste of something real. The next, you're back to corpse ration and algae soup because the supply ran out, or the enforcers confiscated luxury goods. Despite it all, people survive. Human beings are nothing if not adaptable. Over generations, hive populations even come to take a twisted pride in their local cuisine. For instance, the people of one hive might brag that their sump stew, a revolting boil of fungus, rat, and recycled fluids, is superior to the sump stew of a rival hive a continent away. More protein chunks, richer flavor from a unique strain of algae, etc. It's a darkly comic reminder that even in misery, culture finds a way. Let us not sugarcoat it. Hive cities are places where starvation is a constant specter. If a shipment of foodstuffs arrives late, or a gang of thieves intercepts ration crates, thousands can die of hunger in short order. Food riots erupt at the drop of a hat when rations are cut. Hivers will trample and kill each other for a chance at a few extra starch blocks. The Adeptus Arbites, Imperial law enforcement, are always ready to crack skulls to maintain order at distribution centers. It's said that in many hives, the line between a crowd of hungry citizens and a frenzied mob is perilously thin, held in check only by the fear of the Arbites, suppression shields, and shotguns. In summary, in a hive city, nutrition is a matter of plugging the masses with just enough calories to keep them laboring another day. It's a miserable equilibrium. The people never truly thrive, but they don't quite die in mass either, at least not as long as the tithe quotas are met. Everyone is hungry, but most are too fearful or indoctrinated to question it. After all, as the preachers say, the emperor provides. They just don't mention that what he provides might be recycled corpse cake washed down with fungus tea. Dining at the top, the imperial nobility's table. If life at the bottom of a hive is defined by scarcity and filth, life at the top is defined by excess and indulgence. The imperial nobility, planetary governors, hive city lordlings, high-ranking adepts of the administratum, wealthy rogue traders and the like, enjoy privileges undreamed of by the common folk. Nowhere is this contrast more evident than at the dinner table. While the workers below gag on nutrient paste, the nobles feast on delicacies from across the galaxy. For the upper classes of the Imperium, nothing is off the menu as long as it demonstrates status. They routinely import exotic foods from light years away at tremendous expense, simply to flaunt their wealth. A planetary governor on a rich world might have fresh fruit platters from a paradise world orchard flown in every week. A hive city noble clan could bid against rivals for the last barrel of genuine Amasek from a famed distillery. The very idea of local, seasonal produce means nothing when you can ship tropical ocean fish from an equatorial sea or grox steaks from a distant agri-farm via refrigerated shuttle. If it's rare or difficult to obtain, the nobles want it on their table. So what does a noble banquet look like? Imagine a vast dining hall in a spire penthouse, gilded pillars, a vaulted ceiling painted with frescoes of the emperor, and a long table set with fine china and silver. Servitor butlers glide around, pouring drinks and presenting dishes under polished cloches. The host, perhaps a hereditary lord or a wealthy trade magnate, sits at the head with esteemed guests. High-ranking officials, a visiting inquisitor, maybe a space marine chapter master on a diplomatic visit, arrayed along the sides. The meal could consist of a dozen extravagant courses. To start, there might be appetizers like a clear soup made from Terran sunfish, an ancient recipe reserved for the highest tables, or a salad of hydroponically grown leafy greens, a simple luxury virtually extinct outside of noble enclaves. Then the courses ramp up, perhaps a fillet of grox steak as one dish, perfectly seared and served with a sauce of imported herbs and pepper spices that cost a worker's yearly wage per pinch. Alongside it, a casserole of carnosaur meat from a death world safari, or a roast thaka bird from a distant agri moon, essentially exotic analogs to beef or poultry, but sourced from creatures most people have never heard of. Nobles delight in that sort of thing. Ah, this roast beast. It's actually from the death world of Fenk's World's jungles. Absolutely sublime flavor. For starch and vegetables, they have real grains and produce. Fine breads made of off-world wheat, still warm from the oven, and sweet tubers or legumes grown on their private estates. Many noble estates maintain small alopecia gardens, enclosed climate-controlled gardens, where they grow rare vegetables or raise docile animals for fresh dairy and eggs, things a common imperial citizen might consider mythical. And drink? The wine flows freely. They enjoy Amasek, a blanket term for the Imperium's high-quality alcoholic spirits, especially wines and brandies. A well-heeled noble family might have a cellar of Amasek bottles, centuries old, vintages from celebrated agri-world vineyards. They sip glittering glasses of honey-golden Amasek or blood-red warp-fire wine, savoring every note. At particularly opulent feasts, someone might break out a bottle of Fenrisian Mjord, the space wolf's mighty ale, extremely rare outside their chapter, or a cask of ambrosia, an insanely expensive cordial said to be brewed on Holy Terra itself for the upper ecclesiarchy. Only the best will do for the lords of humanity. Desserts and after-dinner treats match the extravagance. Puddings made with real sugar and cream, a rarity since most sugar in the Imperium is synthetic or derived from starchy plants, or multi-layer cakes decorated with candied fruits from a pleasure world. Some nobles indulge in illegal Xenos delicacies as a secret thrill. That's technically heresy, but behind closed doors, a rogue trader might serve something like stewed megarachnids, giant spider-like aliens, to amuse and shock his guests. The highborn often conduct politics during these feasts. Every course is an opportunity to boast or make a deal. They toast the emperor's name with fine crystal glasses because one must always be seen to be pious, even while wallowing in luxury, and engage in polite one-upmanship over who has the more lavish spread. In many ways, these dinners are a weapon and currency of power. Serving a rival a dish they cannot obtain on their own is a way to demonstrate dominance. An invitation to a grand banquet is a sign you're in favor, a seat at the table literally and figuratively. One might wonder, do the nobles ever spare a thought for the starving masses below? On occasion, some do as a kind of performance. It's not unheard of for a governor to throw a token charity feast for a few lucky commoners during a festival, giving them a taste of a fine meal as a propaganda show, while every other commoner watches, hungrier than ever. But generally, the nobility see their dining as their earned privilege. In their view, they shoulder the burden of leadership, so why shouldn't they enjoy the fruits and meats and wines of the galaxy? If a hive's poor riot for food, the nobles simply tighten the security cordon around their spire and keep feasting, perhaps annoyed at the distant sounds of gunfire disturbing their string quartet. Of course, not every highborn is a decadent glutton. A few ascetic souls deliberately eat simple meals out of religious devotion or discipline. Some imperial commanders famously shared their soldiers' rations in solidarity. Sebastian Yarrick, the hero of Armageddon, was said to eat the same trench gruel as his men, to show he was with them. The higher echelons of the ecclesiarchy, the church, preach moderation, and some genuinely live by it. A cardinal of a shrine world might dine on plain bread and water to emulate a saint's example. But such individuals are the rare exception. For every monkish noble surviving on crackers, there are 100 others throwing opulent banquets in gilded halls, their tables groaning under more food than an entire underhive eats in a month. One has to see this in context. In the Imperium, inequality is not a flaw, it's a feature of the social order. The nobles truly believe, and the Imperium's ideology supports, that they are better and more deserving by virtue of their blood or office. Thus, them dining on fine grog steak while the masses eat fungus broth isn't seen as unjust. It's seen as the proper way of things. They might even say a prayer for the souls of those less fortunate. May the Emperor feed the masses with spiritual sustenance as they cut into a real juicy steak. And woe betide a noble whose gluttony crosses into genuine scandal. The Inquisition and Ecclesiarchy do keep an eye out for signs of excessive vice that might lead to heresy. Chaos gods like Slaanesh love to corrupt through overindulgence. A few nobles have vanished after rumors spread of obscene food orgies or cannibalistic debaucheries in their courts. Yes, some have taken their excess that far, hosting secret gatherings where human flesh is consumed for thrill, a sure invitation to demonic corruption. These are extreme cases, though. Most nobility keep their indulgences just this side of outrageously decadent, without tipping into outright heretical depravity. In short, the upper crust of the Imperium live in a completely different world when it comes to food. For them, hunger is a choice. if they're dieting for fashion or penance, not a constant reality. They have the best of everything, the richest foods, the oldest wines, the choicest ingredients and spices from a million worlds. It's a life so far removed from the average imperial citizens that they might as well be a different species. And in the eyes of the Imperium, that's fine. The small folk fuel the high furnaces so that the nobles can eat, and the nobles lead so that the small folk have a purpose. Thus, the grand machine of the Imperium is fed in more ways than one. War and rations, feeding the Imperial Guard. The countless soldiers of the Astra Militarum, Imperial Guard, fight and die on battlefields across the galaxy. But before they can fight, they need to eat. An army, as the ancient Terrans said, marches on its stomach. The Imperium, with characteristically blunt pragmatism, has developed a whole system to keep its troops fed, albeit not in style, but at least in sufficient quantity to keep them going. A standard guardsman's sustenance comes from the Departamento Munitorum in the form of pre-packaged field rations. These are typically issued as daily ration packs, tough, vacuum-sealed pouches that contain a day's worth of food and supplements. The contents are highly standardized to ease mass production and distribution, and engineered for long shelf life rather than taste. Each pack generally includes a high-protein starch meal, often a compressed block of something like hardtack or a dense protein loaf, a tin or pouch of nutrient paste, resembling a thick, flavorless porridge that can be eaten cold or heated, a few vitamin tablets, salt packets, and water purification tablets, and sometimes a little stimulant like a stick of recaf chew gum or caffeine powder. To wash it down, the pack usually has a tea ball or recaf sachet. Just add hot water, if the guardsman is lucky enough to have any, and you get a bitter, energy-boosting drink. These ration packs are designed less for enjoyment and more for efficiency. No cooking is typically required. A guardsman can rip open the paste sachet and squeeze it directly into his mouth on the move. If circumstances permit, troops will heat the paste or hardtack in a mess tin over a fire or a chemical heater to improve palatability. Many Imperial Guard memoirs mention tanna soup, basically recaf or tea used to soften a crumbled ration bar into a makeshift stew which tastes dreadful but is easier to swallow. The taste of standard rations ranges from bland to downright terrible. One common component, the standard issue nutrient paste, is often jokingly called corpse starch pate by soldiers. Only half-jokingly, since in some war zones, it really does include corpse-recycled proteins. This gray gruel has all the nutrients a guardsman needs to keep fighting, but after weeks of nothing else, it can cause digestive issues and a deep longing for anything crunchy or fresh. In fact, the guard's uplifting primer, the little handbook given to all troopers, encourages them to savor your ration. Each bite is the Emperor's strength made manifest, but guardsmen often quip that the Emperor's strength tastes like cardboard. Regardless, they choke it down because an empty stomach on the battlefield is worse. Some variation exists between regiments and war zones. For instance, on extended campaigns, the Munitorum might issue low sticks, cigarettes, or a swig of local spirits as part of the ration to keep morale up, especially for regiments known to have certain habits. Valhallan Ice Warriors, with their cultural love of alcohol, often receive a small allowance of machine spirit vodka in cold climates to keep them warm and compliant. The Vostroyan Firstborn regiments famously include a flask of Rasvod, strong Vostroyan liquor, in each soldier's kit as a traditional ration supplement. Command officially frowns on intoxication, but unofficially, a little booze can go a long way to maintaining morale in the grim trenches. Special circumstances call for special rations. Long-duration patrols might be issued concentrated nutrient bars that pack extra calories, or void ration packs with dehydrated components to reduce weight for drop troops. Conversely, besieged units may end up on half rations, or worse if supplies run low, forcing them to stretch their food. The Munitorum's logistic networks are vast but far from perfect. There are darkly comic tales of regiments receiving crates of unusable items, like 10,000 left boots and no right boots, or in one case, a regiment on an ice planet being mistakenly shipped thousands of ration packs consisting entirely of cooling beverages and dehydrated frozen treats. When rations fail, the Imperial Guard will do whatever is necessary, including foraging locally. Some regiments, like the jungle-fighting Katakan regiments, are experts at living off the land. Katakan soldiers would happily snare small game or eat wild fruit, rather than choke down a tin of Munitorum paste. In fact, it's known that Katakan officers often quietly allow their troops to supplement rations with local flora and fauna, because Katakans have iron stomachs and would rather roast a venomous snake after removing the venom glands, then eat another synthy meal bar. Not all guard units have that luxury, especially those on barren battlefields or alien worlds where local food might be toxic or non-existent. On a dead rock being fought over for a mining outpost, the guard must rely on supply drops. A lapse in the supply line can turn a military campaign into a starvation camp in a matter of weeks. Imperial tacticians plan campaigns obsessively around logistics. They know that more guardsmen have probably died from hunger and disease historically than from enemy Las fire. The Munitorum goes to extreme lengths to avoid outright famine among troops, emergency airdrops, forced reallocations. There are instances of better-fed regiments being ordered to hand over part of their rations to undersupplied regiments nearby, like a grotesque shell game of calories. It doesn't always work, and there have been sieges where guardsmen were reduced to eating battlefield rats, Grox pack animals, and in the most cursed tales, even the flesh of their fallen comrades, though any officer with sense keeps such desperation quiet. The commissars would rather execute starving men tainted by cannibalism than admit an imperial force was allowed to fall into such dire straits. For morale, little things matter. Many guardsmen develop almost childlike attachments to small treats in the ration packs. A packet of recaf or a sugary nutrient tablet becomes a cherished highlight of the day. Troopers often trade ration components with each other to suit tastes. One soldier swaps his protein loaf for his buddy's caffeine sticks. Another hates the salted meat paste and trades it for extra crackers. They concoct hodgepodge stews by mixing everything in a canteen cup and heating it over a Chimera exhaust port, jokingly giving their sludge grand names like Cadia Regiment Special or Five-Ingredient Trench Surprise. These small rituals and jokes help guardsmen cope with the relentless monotony of campaign life. Alcohol, as mentioned, also finds its way into the ranks. If not provided, soldiers will improvise. In nearly every war zone, some enterprising guardsmen will set up a field still to ferment whatever they can find, be it stolen ration fruits, grain from horse feed, or even coolant alcohol from vehicles, filtered, hopefully. The resulting brews are foul and potentially blinding, but a quick swig of guardsman's grog can steady trembling hands and give a momentary blissful escape. Commanders often turn a blind eye to minor drinking as long as it doesn't impede duty. They know that a semi-drunk soldier might be a happier, more courageous soldier, up to a point. During long sieges or after a major victory, it's common for officers to actually issue a rum ration or equivalent, just as was done in ancient times, to celebrate and raise spirits. One cannot discuss feeding the guard without mentioning the staggering scale of it. A crusade army might number in the millions of troops. Feeding that many mouths each day is an imperial-grade challenge. The supply ships for a crusade fleet are essentially flying grain silos, and the administratum clerks who manage food distribution have an unenviable job. Many a logistician has ended up in a shallow grave or servitor lobotomy after miscalculating a division's rations and causing a preventable starvation incident. The paperwork alone for allocating daily calories to a segmentum's war effort could fill a hablock with scribbled parchment. Yet somehow, through a mix of careful planning, draconian discipline, and the heroism of countless anonymous supply servitors, the Imperial war machine usually gets fed. Usually. In battle, an army's mess can be almost as important as its ammo. A well-fed soldier fights harder. Imperial tacticians know this. That's why propaganda constantly reassures guardsmen that the Emperor provides for them, and why failing to protect one's own supply lines is considered a severe tactical blunder and sometimes a court-martial offense for a commander. Conversely, denying the enemy food is a legitimate tactic. The Imperium will gleefully destroy a rebel planet's crops or blockade a traitor hive to starve out the heretics. It can endure being called cruel so long as victory is achieved. After all, to be fed is to be alive and under Imperial protection. To be starved is the fate of the enemy and the unworthy. To sum up the guardsmen's dining experience, it's not pleasant, it's not pretty, but it works, mostly. A trooper on campaign may dream of a hot home-cooked meal, but he'll settle for a reheated tin of standard-issue mystery stew if it means he has the strength to see tomorrow's battle. In the grim calculus of war, food is just another resource, measured, rationed, and, when necessary, sacrificed. The average guardsman understands this deeply, as many a sarcastic infantryman has etched on the lid of their mess tin. If war doesn't kill me, the rations might. Always followed by, but I'll die with a full belly for the Emperor. Superhuman sustenance, the Space Marine diet. The Adeptus Astartes. The Space Marines are the elite transhuman warriors of the Imperium. These mighty warriors have been engineered to be superior to normal humans in every way, and that includes how and what they eat. One might assume the Space Marines dine like kings given their status. The truth is both more utilitarian and more bizarre. Space Marines can consume things that would kill an ordinary human, and in a pinch they can even go without food for extended periods, but they still need fuel for their enhanced bodies. Firstly, thanks to a suite of implanted organs, such as the preomnor, essentially a secondary stomach that neutralizes poisons, a Space Marine can eat almost anything organic and derive nutrition from it. They can drink toxic or brackish water, and it'll be purified in their gut. They could chew raw alien flesh or plants that would be highly poisonous to a normal man, and not only survive but be nourished. On long campaigns, Space Marines have been known to ingest things like mold scraped from dungeon walls or the bark of strange trees when supplies ran low. Their bodies strip out what's useful and reject the rest. This extreme omnivory is a huge advantage in survival situations. Though Marines themselves aren't fond of boasting about eating, say, moss and rats during a prolonged siege, it's just another duty they endure without complaint. In their chapter fortresses or aboard their strike cruisers, Space Marines are provisioned with specialized rations much more potent and tailored to their biology than what ordinary troops get. The staple for many chapters is a kind of high-protein nutrient concentrate, often in the form of a thick gel or gruel. For example, the Ultramarines are said to favor a bland but perfectly balanced amino porridge, eaten quickly in a communal refectory before they return to drills. The Dark Angels have something known as Nutri-Mash, a dull gray concoction that nonetheless keeps their gene-enhanced bodies in peak form. These foods are rich in all the requirements a superhuman Astarte's physique demands. Vastly more calories than a normal human diet, plus a cocktail of trace elements to support their implants and dense musculature. The Space Marines of some chapters do have particular traditions surrounding food and drink. The most famous example is the Space Wolves of Fenris, who inject a bit of boisterous warrior culture into their sustenance. The Space Wolves maintain feast halls and have legendary celebrations after battle. They brew a potent ale called Fenrisian Mjöd, so strong that a human would pass out from a single tankard. But it takes several barrels to get a Space Wolf even pleasantly tipsy. They pair this with massive joints of roast meat from the great beasts of Fenris, giant elk, ice whales, and worse. During their feasts, Space Wolves engage in roaring drinking contests and eating competitions, bonding as only that rowdy chapter can. Many other chapters might frown on such indulgence. But for the Space Wolves, it's a time-honored way to celebrate victory and brotherhood. Their hyper-metabolism ensures they can binge and then be battle-ready shortly after, one of the perks of being engineered by the Emperor. Most chapters, however, are more restrained. Communal meals are usually taken in silence or with solemn ritual. A chapter's reclusium, chaplains, might lead a prayer before eating, thanking the Emperor for sustenance. The food is simple but exceedingly efficient. Marines don't eat for pleasure, Space Wolves aside. They eat as another form of duty. Many a battle brother will finish his portion in a few bites and sit, eyes closed, meditating on the day's lessons while others finish. That said, Astartes do possess the capacity to enjoy flavor when it's there. There are accounts from the Great Crusade era of Space Marines showing polite appreciation for fine cuisine offered by human diplomats or even Xeno's hosts, before the Imperium forbade such contact. The Emperor's Children Legion notably once sampled Eldar dishes during a temporary alliance. Their enhanced physiology found the alien flavors interesting and thankfully non-toxic. Still, such situations are rare. Nowadays, a Space Marine would more likely view a fancy meal as a tactical inconvenience. Why are we wasting time with this banquet instead of fortifying defenses? Then a delight. One of the strangest aspects of Space Marine physiology related to eating is the omophagia, also called the remembrancer or even cannibal gland. This implanted organ allows a marine to absorb memories or genetic information by consuming the flesh, especially the brain, of a creature. Yes, that means a space marine can, in theory, gain an enemy's knowledge by literally eating them. This is every bit as gruesome as it sounds, and it's not something marines do often, outside of certain chapters with savage reputations. But it has been done. For instance, it's rumored the Carcharodons, space sharks, chapter ritually consume portions of particularly worthy foes to learn from them and terrify everyone else. Loyalist Marines keep such practices very quiet and rarely resort to them because it's seen as skirting the edge of dishonor and madness. Still, in dire circumstances, an Astartes scout or apothecary might take a bite of a dead enemy's heart or brain to quickly glean battlefield intel. It's a tool in their arsenal, albeit a macabre one. And if that conjures images of literal brain-eating super soldiers, well, in the 41st millennium, that's a real thing that happens. It goes without saying that Marines do not suffer squeamishness around food. They view their ability to digest almost anything as a gift from the Emperor to be used when needed. In battle, a Marine unit cut off from resupply will do whatever it takes to keep going. If that means roasting and eating local wildlife, or in truly dire straits, making corpse starch from the dead as normal humans do, they will. The difference is a Space Marine feels no shame in it. It's all towards completing the mission. Space Marines also have another edge. Most wear power armor that has an integrated nutrient recycling system. When sealed in armor for long periods, a marine suit can recycle his body's wastes and sweat into a rudimentary fluid that can sustain him. It's not delicious. Imagine a thin broth of filtered urine and processed body oils. Lovely. But it means a marine can function longer without outside food or water. There are recorded sieges where a squad of Astartes held a position for weeks with zero supplies, sustained only by their armor's recyclers and their own considerable endurance. This is why a marine can fight on a toxic ash waste or an airless moon and not collapse. Even if supply lines are cut, they are walking self-contained fortresses. For all these advantages, space marines do enjoy certain familiar comforts when they have the chance. Take the Imperial Fists. Chapter. They have a tradition called the Feast of Blades for victors of their tournament, where the champions share a private banquet as a mark of honor. The food is said to be simple but hearty Terran fare, a nod to their Primarch's heritage. The Blood Angels, Marines, refined and cultured, are known to appreciate fine vintage Amasek and artfully prepared dishes when garrisoned on their homeworld Bale. Albeit their cursed gene seed gives them a penchant for the metaphorical and sometimes literal taste of blood, so their toasts and meals always have a tinge of gothic drama. Meanwhile, the salamanders of Nocturne, compassionate and tied to their human roots, often cook meals for their human allies or share treats with the civilian children after a battle, a rare warmth from godlike warriors. But that's the character of the salamanders. These little glimpses show that even space marines retain some humanity in how they view food, as something that can build camaraderie, honor traditions, or comfort those they protect. In summary, a space marine's diet is a perfect example of function over form. They eat to fight, whether it's squeezing down a tube of nutrient paste in the field or partaking in a roaring victory feast back at the Fang. If you're a space wolf, a marine's eating habits are just another extension of his role as the Emperor's weapon. And if sometimes that role requires literally devouring the enemy to know them, well, the Emperor provides in mysterious ways. Conclusion. Food in the Imperium of Man isn't just about sustenance. It's a microcosm of the Imperium itself. It's vast, grossly unequal, often horrific, occasionally heroic, and always an exercise in brute force logistics and devotion. From agri-world farmers laboring under poisonous skies to put grain in the bellies of strangers on distant worlds, to hive city paupers dutifully chewing their corpse starch rations, to generals and nobles raising crystal goblets of Amasek in toast, every morsel consumed in the 41st millennium tells a story of humanity's struggle to endure. In this grand empire, entire planetary populations live on the brink of starvation so that war fleets and city-sized forges can have enough to keep going. The Imperium manages to feed quintillions of humans only by methods as extreme as the wars it fights, gutting planets of all native life to create monoculture farms, recycling the dead into gruel, and shipping food across deadly void routes with fanatic precision. There is nothing gentle or fair about the process. If a few billion die from famine on one world, the administratum will shrug and mark it up as a regrettable shortfall, and the survivors will likely be fed from those very dead. If an army's ration shipments are delayed, they're expected to tighten their belts, eat local vermin, or each other if they must. Whatever it takes to hold the line for the Emperor. The line between life and death in the Imperium is as thin as a nutrient cracker. Yet, against all grim odds, the Imperium does survive, and so do its people, in a fashion. In a galaxy filled with slavering xenos and ravenous demons, mankind endures partly because it's willing to stomach the unthinkable. The average Imperial citizen might not have much, maybe just a daily bowl of gray porridge and a prayer, but they give thanks for it because they know others have even less. The soldier might gag on his ration paste, but he eats it resolutely, muttering, "The Emperor's strength tastes awful, but it keeps me strong." The noble guzzles his fifth course of the night and thinks, "How fortunate that I was born to receive all this." While far below, a starving mother divides her meager fungi bread among her children and thinks, "How fortunate that the Emperor granted us this meal." Faith and food are deeply intertwined. Both are forms of sustenance in a cruel, uncaring universe. If there is any dark comfort to be found, it's that in the Imperium, everyone is ultimately in the same feast or famine boat. Even the richest hive lord depends on agri-world crops and trade routes protected by the Imperial Navy. If those fail, he starves just like the serfs, though he'll be the last to feel it. Even the strongest space marine needs fuel for his genetically wrought body. If the chapter's apothecaries can't synthesize nutrients, even an Astartes will waste away, albeit slower than a normal man. In a very real sense, food, or lack thereof, is one of the few truly democratic forces left in the Imperium. It doesn't care about your pedigree or purity, only about feeding those who have it and killing those who don't. So next time you sit down to a meal, consider sparing a thought for the citizens of the Imperium of Man. In hive cities and trench lines, in voidships and manufactorum barracks, untold billions are hoping that the next fist-sized nutrition bar or cup of algae broth will keep them alive one more day. They chew, swallow, and endure, all in the name of a distant emperor. In the grim darkness of the far future, it is not only war that is hell. Every mealtime is a battle. Bon appetit, citizens. Eat what you're given. Waste nothing. And pray it's enough. In the Imperium of Man, survival itself is the Emperor's feast, and every plate, no matter how grim, is sacred.